Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Hello, welcome to the Emerald Podcast Series. My name is Thomas and my guest today is Rob Noonan, a reader in health and education at the University of Bolton here in the UK. He's also the author of the book Capitalism, Health and Wellbeing, Rethinking Global Economic Growth for a Healthier, Sustainable Future, published by Emerald. I hope you enjoy this episode. It's a real pleasure to have you. I've been spending the morning reading your book, Capitalism, Health and Wellbeing. And just first of all, can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so one of the drivers to writing the book is I've taught in higher education now for about a decade and across many subject areas ranging from public health to sports science to psychology. And often the material and the discussions that I have with the students tend to relate to some of them societal challenges that we face, from health inequalities, obesity, mental health, to physical inactivity. And one of the challenges that I've had is signposting students to one or perhaps a couple of books that links all these challenges together and essentially gives them a clearer sense of what's really happening, and more importantly, why it's happening. So I wrote the book for that particular reason, to fill this gap. But the second reason relates to the work that I do as a researcher. So a lot of the work that I do tends to focus on the behavioural and the environmental determinants of health. And what I mean by that is how the environment shapes health behaviours and how these health behaviours then influence people's health. And during this time, I've become a strong believer and arguably an advocate for tackling the social determinants of health. And what this means is that social determinants of health are, in many respects, relate to our health being the product of the places in which we're born, we grow, we live, and we later age. But despite this evidence supporting the social determinants, it continues to remain largely absent from the public and also the political debate. And in recent years and recent decades, we've seen lots of evidence and lots of news stories and so on. Life expectancy stalling, obesity, physical inactivity levels rising. We see more and more people taking prescription medication to deal with their psychological suffering. And what this tells us is it tells us that something's not quite right. It tells us something's not right with society. It tells us that it's not an individual level problem. It's a societal one. It's down to structural factors. So I wrote the book for that purpose, to spark a curiosity and a conversation for how a healthier and more sustainable future is possible.
And you mentioned in the book how we've had this laser focus on GDP.
Yeah, so as a society, we obsess about growing the economy, baking a bigger cake, essentially. And rarely do we actually think about the societal costs of doing so. So the pursuit of economic growth, as I argue in the book, has become a much higher priority than protecting and improving the nation's health. And a question, or a couple of questions that I pose in the book, is what if the economy grows because more people are consuming poor quality food and obesity levels go up? You could also argue, what if the economy grows because more people are buying bigger vehicles, driving them more often, leading to inactivity levels going up, air pollution going up, congestion going up, and also more people dying on the roads? And then you could also argue that the economy might grow because more people are suffering psychologically, are turning to alcohol or turning to drugs or perhaps even resorting to taking their own life. So the message there is, the economy might grow, but what good is this if society gets sicker? That's the first point. And then the second point relating to the GDP aspect, Thomas, is that something else that's rarely discussed is how this growth is achieved and what impact it has on our lives. So what you have to think about is, for the economy to grow, this means that productivity levels need to rise, which means the consumption levels need to rise because it needs to meet supply. But if you dig a bit further, dig a bit deeper, this means that goods have to be manufactured faster. It means the services have to be delivered faster. It means that the goods and services that are consumed have to be consumed more often. So this means then that workers have to work faster or work longer. And they don't just have to do this to boost productivity. Here's the crux of it. They have to do so to earn the money to meet the ever-rising consumption patterns. So essentially, they need to live their lives faster. And that has costs. It has costs on their health. It has costs on the environment. So here's the point. One of the easiest ways to feel less stressed for a lot of people, not all, but a lot of people, is to slow down. But slowing down isn't an option when the ultimate goal is to grow the economy. In fact, you could argue that it's a cancer to the capitalist system that we've currently got.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking of a small businessman I know who described his life as the constant running faster and faster and faster in order to stand still.
Yes, mostly. Yes, so they call that the hedonic treadmill, don't they? On that particular point, so your third factor that I pick up in the book as well, linked to the two that I've just mentioned, is that economic historians have detailed now very clearly and very comprehensively. They've argued that economic growth does have costs, and these costs show in the fact that you have increased levels of deprivation, which leads to increased rates of disease and increased rates of death. And a lot of the discussion, a lot of the content that they've talked about relates to the Victorian era, when you're seeing that, you know, infectious diseases going through the roof, when you had airborne diseases and waterborne diseases, people dying of cholera, you know, in the late 1800s. And what was needed back then was regulation. There was needed an awful lot of kind of investment from the government to tackle what you could argue is the social determinants of health. As I talk in the book, these particular economic historians talk about the four Ds: disruption, deprivation, disease, and death. And what they say is, if this particular process is not kind of rectified by the state, the government, so instead of implementing the policies that would limit the disruption and lessen the insecurity and the health effects, in recent years and recent decades, if I think about the UK in particular, they've tended to do the opposite. And the message in the book is, by virtue of doing that, the governments are locked in a vicious cycle, I call it, of spending huge sums of public money to put right the harms that in many respects their pursuit of growth and their own policies have created. And, you know, listeners will see that in not just the evidence that's out there, but the news headlines around weakened welfare states, decimated public services, and not tackling the externalities of economic activity. And what I mean by externalities of economic activity, let me give you an example. One of the greatest achievements in public health, and certainly the last couple of centuries, has been the separation of human waste, human feces, from water. You know, that led to huge improvements, I mentioned before, in cutting down, you know, the rate of cholera and some of the other waterborne diseases. But we've seen in recent years, by virtue of not being tough on regulation, what happens, you know, where some of this waste is now going into some of our waterways hundreds of thousands of times every year. And these are the very, very places that young people play and swim. And, you know, in recent times, governments have actually even voted in favour of allowing this for time to come. So that's just one of the other examples of what happens where there's not strong regulation. I know I haven't mentioned yet, but we often think about some of the benefits of free market capitalism. The advocates and the proponents of it will talk about freedom and choice. But often what's missing in that particular discussion is freedom for whom? Freedom for whom? That's very important, because freedom for one person doesn't necessarily mean freedom for the other. So the example I provide there, you give companies freedom to just do whatever they want so that they can increase profit margins and make their shareholders even wealthier. That could have drastic effects on communities and individuals. The example I provide there related to water. You know, so many examples that we could provide here, whether it's around the market and advertising of very poor quality foods, whether it's around some of the other types of emissions that we see in society. So there's lots of examples. There are ways of being able to mitigate some of the costs of capitalism, which we've seen after the Second World War. But in recent years, them regulations that are needed haven't always been implemented.
Absolutely. After the end of the Second World War, we have the Bevan report taking us forward. And more recently, we've had austerity.
Yes, most definitely. Yeah. Well, that's one of the other things that I talk about in the book. It's the kind of elephant in the room, you could argue, in the fact that one of the reports that came out in recent years by the British Medical Association, who'd consulted with a range of different doctors and physicians from around the UK, the title of the report was called "The Country is Getting Sicker." And they talked about how some of these changes that we'd seen by virtue of austerity had contributed to population health worsening at a drastic scale. And there's been lots of reports that have come out at the start of the year, authored by Sir Michael Marmot, and some of the work that's done through the Institute of Health Equity, where they demonstrated that not only have health inequalities widened, but life expectancy is stalled, and in some parts of the country has actually gone backwards, certainly for people living in the most deprived parts of the country. But that report that I mentioned by the British Medical Association, they talked about how weakened public services and rising in work poverty and a broken safety net have contributed. These are them social determinants that I mentioned at the start of our talk today. You know, what we tend to see is the government tending to favour what I often call a stick and plaster approach to rectify some of the social and health costs of growing the economy. They tend to favour these particular approaches, I argue, because they align with short-term electoral cycles and they closely align with the profit motive. But these particular decisions have costs, as I've just alluded to. And, you know, one of the things that we see in society at the moment has been issues around young people's mental health, which has arguably been exacerbated with the COVID-19 pandemic and, you know, more isolation and more remote work and so on for young people. But at a time when young people's mental health is at crisis levels, a lot of the preventative services have been curtailed. If you think about youth clubs, you know, they don't only just provide a safe space for young people, but they provide a sense of belonging. And these types of preventative services, you know, there's a lot of evidence to support the value of them.
And you mentioned in your book the importance of, you know, belonging, of community, of togetherness.
Most definitely, yeah. Some of these other preventative measures as well around Sure Start centres. So there's been a substantial amount of research that's been done. They were implemented by the Labour government. And some of the research that's been done has been into the benefit that they have on reducing health inequalities. So again, there's evidence to support the benefits of these types of programs, but again, they've been cut. If you look at leisure centres, again, they are, in many respects, hubs of the community. We know that we have a huge issue with physical activity in our country, and arguably, you know, in many of the developed world. One of the reports that came out by the World Health Organization recently evidenced this. But again, at the time when we have some of these public health crises, a lot of the preventative measures that can support people being active, whether that's green space, whether that's making our communities more walkable, whether that's investment in some of our, you know, leisure centres that in many respects support people from vulnerable backgrounds and, you know, in some of the deprived communities, we don't necessarily put support and investment into them particular areas. You know, you could argue that some of these leisure facilities should really come under public health because they do have, you know, a huge public health benefit. But again, because they're not part of the statutory funding, if there's cuts to be made, it's often to these particular services.
Oh, absolutely. I live in a small town and the swimming pool was closed a few years ago. And previously, all the young kids would, you know, they'd happily play there. They've got their community. They've got their groups. Whereas now, where can they go? It's a small town. There's not a huge number of options for them except, well, sit on the sofa, play video games, hang around at a bus stop.
Most definitely, yeah. So, and then what you tend to see then is the data starts to come out and start to say, well, actually, the health of young people's deteriorating, their physical health's deteriorating because they're spending more time being sedentary. The mental health is deteriorating because they're spending more time alone, perhaps, you know, isolated. You may start to see more kind of antisocial behaviour. You might start to see more crime on the streets. And, you know, very rarely do we then actually see discussions around the fact that, well, I'll tell you why we're seeing these issues in society. We're seeing them now because it's a domino effect, because we've cut services or taken funds from one area, and now we're having to treat that particular problem in society. Another example that can provide is one of the other public health challenges that the country has at the moment around loneliness and isolation, certainly in older people. And in 2018, the government introduced, this may come as a surprise for some listeners, they introduced their very own loneliness minister and implemented a strategy around loneliness. And we know that some of the evidence around community facilities that are beneficial, not just for communities, but at the individual level, and giving people a safe space to go, are things like libraries. Libraries don't just give people access to books and digital resources. It gives them the opportunity to go somewhere, you know, and actually meet people and get like a sense of belonging, cut down isolation and so on. And there's evidence to support the benefit, the social value.
Absolutely. I mean, I was surprised to see a sign in a library recently saying, you know, please talk. You know, if you're reading a book, talk to your neighbour about it.
Yeah. But again, you know, if there's funding cuts to be made, you often tend to find, as we've seen, that it tends to be in these particular areas.
I'm very interested. We've been focusing mainly on the UK, but your book also has a global perspective.
Yeah, it does. I think that, you know, I touched upon some of the factors. Most of the issues that I talk about do tend to be in relation to high-income countries, because a lot of the issues that they face from a health perspective is down to their stage of economic development. So there are some points in terms of talk about issues to do with crime in some of the other countries, where I'm talking about some of the what happens when poverty is high and people turn into crime and so on. But you could also, there are still striking parallels with our country in particular. And I think that them particular points that are mentioned, certainly around poverty, relate to jobs, because when we think about people's income, and we're thinking about poverty, it's often in the context of people's wages. But actually, people's income is the product of wage and number of hours worked. And a conversation I was having with a friend the other day was around the fact that there's so many people in society now, in one of the richest nations around, who live hand to mouth. Essentially, every day they tread water to get by. They go to work, they remain poor, they rely on food charity. Some of the excellent work that's done by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, some of the reports that they've published in recent years, evidence almost roughly 70% of people who are classified as living in relative poverty live in a household with at least one working member. And some of the evidence around the consequences, the health consequences of absolute material deprivation, they date back to, you know, the Victorian era. They date back centuries ago. We've known what the impact are when people don't have enough money to be able to survive. If you think about the book that was written in the 1840s by Friedrich Engels, it was called The Condition of the Working Class in England. And what he talks about in this book is his argument is, you know, the living and working conditions brought on by the capitalist system back then resulted in health inequalities, and these health inequalities sent the English working class prematurely to the grave. And there's no doubt that living standards, people's quality of life, and so on has moved on astronomically in the last 150, 200 years, life expectancy much greater and so on. Different types of challenges that people face, and as I mentioned before, you still see that them consequences of them, not just income inequalities, but the resultant health inequalities.
Oh yes, and you mentioned The short distances apart that people can live and have extraordinarily different, not just life expectancies, but expectancies of health.
Huge, yeah. So we often think about life expectancy, which is exceptionally important. But what's also important is healthy life expectancy. You might find that someone, you know, may live till they're 78, but actually the last 28 years of their life have been horrendous. You know, it's been very, very uncomfortable for them every single day to just get by because they've just been chronically ill. They've been suffering from, you know, a combination of different chronic illnesses. And I mentioned before one particular book that's a favourite of mine, but arguably the favourite book of mine is The Ragged Trousers of Philanthropist by the author Robert Tressel, whose actual name was Robert Noonan. Tressel was his pen name. And the reason why I flagged that up is my book was published on the 22nd of April, 2024. And Tressel's book was published 23rd of April, 1914. So almost 110 years to the day. And the reason why that's got striking parallels, not just in terms of dates of publication and name, but its message, because he was saying 110 years ago, his main message was around how the capitalist system, you know, was degrading on the health of the English working class. And also as well, he died before the book went to publication, and he was buried in a pauper's grave in Liverpool, which was the city that I was born and raised and so on. So there's so many different parallels to them two books. So he was talking about the social determinants back then. He was saying that the pills and the medicine that he's given by the doctors back then, it's not really going to do him all that good because he still has to endure them horrendous working and living conditions, surviving daily, you know, and worrying the kind of psychological trauma of, you know, is he going to be able to afford a loaf of bread?
And work has become more and more insecure with fixed-term contracts, zero-hours contracts, and even living conditions with no-fault evictions here in the UK.
Yeah, most definitely, yeah. One of the books that was published over a decade ago now, I think it was in 2011, was by an author, Guy Standing. It's a really good book. It's called The Precariat, and he talks about then how we started to see a huge rise in precarious work and the impact that has, you know, the psychological impact that it has. One of the other factors that very rarely gets discussed is the fact that when people are in precarious work and perhaps not only are the wages low, but perhaps they haven't got the number of hours that they need to be able to earn the income that they need to meet their living costs, they then have to work a second job or they have to work a third job. And the point is, the reason why that's an issue is not only is it physically demanding and, you know, psychologically taxing on them, but it has an indirect effect on their health because, as I talk about in the book, some of them well-being enhancing activities that was evidenced by the New Economics Foundation in 2008, when they published the report on the five ways to well-being, the activities that the NHS advocate and encourage, connecting, being active, taking notice and learning and giving, these are the types of activities that economically cost very, very little. They just cost people's time. And as people are having or indirectly forced to work more to survive, they don't have the opportunity then to engage in these activities where there's strong evidence showing that it's health enhancing, such as, you know, meeting with family members and friends and so on. So that's another way. It has a double kind of consequence, a double burden. It doesn't just have a direct effect through the disproportionate kind of share of physical stresses. It has an indirect effect on health as well.
Well, that's very, very interesting. And again, you mentioned the importance of Liverpool in your work and in your thinking.
Yeah, so I guess I mentioned this briefly in the book in terms of, you know, from a very young age, you start to see the importance of the environment and how the environment shapes health behaviours and how health behaviours shape health. And, you know, what I could see from a very young age is the cost that this has on people's health by virtue of the opportunities that they have available to them. And I mention in the book, in terms of the government's often focused on that stick and plaster approach that I mentioned before, rather than actually investing in communities, investing in green spaces, investing in, you know, opportunities for people to be able to go to places where they can socialize. And a lot of these costs that the system can bring along, significant regulation and redistribution can be put in place through, you know, income and wealth distribution. But what we've actually seen in recent years is the government often doing the opposite. So if we're thinking about income inequalities, when the government decides or favour cutting taxes for wealthy individuals, what this does is this lessens the distribution of wealth and widens income inequality. When they dismantle trade union power, it gives companies, it gives employers greater freedom to suppress workers' wages. I know we had the conversation earlier on where we talked about that in terms of freedom and freedom for whom. And I think if you give companies freedom to, you know, make changes to terms and conditions of workers, whether that's around working harder for longer or, you know, putting them into precarious work, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's favourable freedom for the individual who's on the receiving end of them particular decisions. But also as well, something that I focus on in the book is around things to do with obesity and physical inactivity. And, you know, something that I feel very, very passionately around is around delays in regulations aimed at limiting marketing of junk food. There's a substantial amount of evidence that's out there from academics in the University of Liverpool and many other institutions around the consequences of food advertising on young people's dietary choices.
You did mention in the book people working long hours and maybe a second job and then grabbing a quick ready meal and then having a drink in the evening rather than doing something healthy. And I was slightly concerned you had a camera in my house.
I haven't done that. I guess, you know, if that is the case, it's probably quite consistent and a mirror image for so many people, because it comes back to that productivity. What's at the heart of the book is the consequences of a focus on productivity and going faster and faster, and a focus on consumption. And a lot of them issues that I allude to in the book are relating to that in terms of the productivity aspect and the consumption aspect. And from a physical activity perspective, you know, coming back to the regulations, the government, in a lot of cases, you know, decide to drop regulations that in many respects would cut car use, improve air quality, and make neighbourhoods safer and walkable. The very things that actually are needed to be able to make positive improvements to create environments that support people to be able to be physically active. You know, I mentioned in the book in terms of some of the policy actions that could be done. You know, there's two big policy actions that I talk about, and one of them's around regulation, which we've spoken about an awful lot today. You know, the regulations are country's most powerful mechanism, you could argue, to tame some of these impacts that we've been talking about. Change culture, change behaviour. Lots of examples. We talked before in terms of sanitary reform, but you think about legislation around seatbelt use. You think about some of the positive improvements that's been made in terms of smoking cessation through restrictions in public spaces. There's lots of examples of success stories where there's been a combination of different multi-pronged approaches to tackling some of these kind of societal challenges. If we add restrictions, more restrictions around advertising that challenge people's health and well-being, that's one way that you could make a dent. Another option is designing our communities, not just for cars, but for people. You know, we design our communities for cars, very car dependent, but then, you know, people are kind of encouraged to be physically active. But, you know, the streets and the roads around our communities, they're everyone's. But we've built up this kind of thought that they're actually for cars, they're not for pedestrians, they're not for cyclists. And a point I make in the book is that, you know, we should have more investment in these particular areas, because we should be supporting people to be physically active. The government needs to ensure that everyone has the opportunity to be active, to play, to connect, and above all, be safe in their community. And the other point that I make, which is a little bit more kind of, you know, it's a much bigger task and will take a much, much longer time to be able to achieve, is around changing the goal of the economy, you know, which is a consistent narrative throughout the book. Talk about regulation and the benefits that it could have, and I've spoken about some of the other examples that you can see in the century where that's been useful. But if you change the goal, this ensures that everyone's reading off the same sheet. One of the issues that we tend to face, not just in the public sector, but right across all sectors, is this joined up thinking. I think it was in 2006 now, you know, the concept of health in all policies was spoken about. Health in all policies, and what it means by that is intersectoral collaboration, basically, to make sure that if you're in planning, Thomas, and I'm in health, and we've got someone else who's in education, making sure that the policies that are put in place and the decisions that may are getting us towards this shared objective, making sure the health is the main objective. But we actually see, based on some of the evidence that are presented here, that actually you could argue that we haven't made a great deal of progress in that area. And it's often down to the fact that what I alluded to before, in terms of them short-term economic gains being taken rather than the expense of the health and the societal costs further down the line. If I come back to that policy approach now, the goal is around wealth over health. But if you switch the narrative, if you change the narrative and you say, well, actually, no, health is going to be more important than wealth, and you start to recognize that actually social justice is really important, well-being is really important, and actually social justice and well-being are going to be valued more than money. You change the narrative then. And essentially what I'm getting at is it's time to measure some of these particular outcomes alongside the economic targets.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. For more information about Rob Noonan and for a transcript of today's episode, please see our show notes on our website. I would like to thank Daniel Ridge for his help with today's episode, and also Alex Jungius from This Is Distorted. You've been listening to the Emerald Podcast Series.